This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Say the words climate change and just watch the battle lines form. On the one side, those who say it's not only coming, it's here, and we are going to be challenged by extreme weather as a consequence. On the other side, those who doubt the grim warnings of climate scientists. They believe warming is just a part of nature's cycle. The political minefields associated with those words, climate change, are causing local leaders to look for ways to prepare for extreme weather without actually saying they are. John Flesher is an environmental reporter for the Associated Press. Hello, John.
Nice to be with you.
And Andy Hoffman is here. He's director of the Urb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan, where he's also the Holcim U.S. Professor of Sustainable Enterprise. That's quite a mouthful, Andy. Good to have you here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
John, you looked at what some local communities around the nation are doing to prepare for extreme weather. And yet, as you say in your report, climate change is like Voldemort, the archenemy of the Harry Potter series. It's the issue that cannot be named. Are we seeing this pretty much across the country?
Well, it varies. I came across this idea when I was covering a meeting conference at the University of Michigan back in June. It dealt with this issue of adaptation to climate change, and there were people from a number of fields who were there, academics and state and local officials, business leaders and others. And I was struck by the number of times at different sessions where people would talk about how in dealing with people in communities to talk about how to adapt, how to prepare for what was coming in the future, they would find it advantageous to sort of step around the words climate change, or at least to downplay that idea, because they didn't want to get bogged down in a lot of political debate and this argument that's been going on for a long time and probably will continue. So I started to look into it further and began to place some calls around the country to different groups and found that it certainly is a recurrent theme that you're hearing in a lot of places, particularly in areas where the local political atmosphere tends to be pretty conservative and people lean in that direction, and climate change or global warming are very touchy subjects. Now, it doesn't happen everywhere. There certainly are plenty of examples that you could look at where people are able to speak openly about it. Just recently, this month, in St. Paul, Minnesota, the mayor there had a session where he invited about 50 elected leaders from his state and from Wisconsin to talk about the adaptation, and they said openly it's in the face of climate change. So it's not like sort of a nationwide thing that's happening everywhere, but it is happening a lot. And I think the point is, again, people who want to deal with the nuts and bolts of preparing for what is going to come don't want to get caught up in the argument that seems to go on without end. And so it's often just a matter of what vocabulary you use, what language you use to try to move forward and make progress and bring people together, regardless of what their beliefs on the broader climate change issue are.
Andy Hoffman, you work with both environmental and business issues. Are local politicians who do this, are they tapping into some effective business tactics by carefully choosing the language they're using to talk about what it is they're doing?
Absolutely. Companies are experiencing the same thing that John is describing in his argument or in his article with communities. Climate change has got caught up in the culture wars in this country, and surveys show that the majority of Democrats believe it's real. The majority of Republicans do not. The words climate change and global warming are different. And a lot of early work showed that you can use the words interchangeably with liberal Democratic communities. With conservative Republican communities, global warming is most likely to get the pushback than climate change is. More recent work says that that's gone away, that both terms are offensive in the more Republican communities. But companies are facing a similar dilemma. They need to adapt their operations, but do they want to weigh into what has become a nasty political issue, or do they just want to come out and say, this is an operational issue, and we're going to address it in a way that makes sense for our bottom line?
Getting very pragmatic about it.
Absolutely.
John, you've looked at, among other cities, Grand Haven as an example of dealing with climate change without saying you're dealing with climate change. Give us some ideas of what they're doing there.
Sure. Well, in Grand Haven, this is one of several communities in Michigan that is dealing with the Land Information Access Association. This is an organization based in Traverse City. that works with local communities on various issues. And more recently, they've had this project of going in and working with people on what they call resiliency. And it involves looking at their community master plan and deciding whether zoning changes need to be made or infrastructure improvements need to be made, that type of thing, to get people ready for what may be coming. And in Grand Haven, you know, that's a community right on Lake Michigan. They've had some flooding issues in the past. So they are doing things already, like putting up green roofs in a number of places where you have plants on top of roofs that can help absorb rainwater and avoid runoff, that type thing. There are a number of other things that they're doing, infrastructure improvements they're looking at. Their waste treatment plant there is going to be going solar pretty soon. And so they're quite proud of this, and yet their mayor, who I interviewed, is someone who does not really buy into the climate change phenomenon. She acknowledges that it may be happening, but isn't convinced that it isn't just part of the natural cycle, and is pretty skeptical of all of that. And so she's willing to let this process go forward and for Grand Haven to be a part of it, but would prefer to focus very pragmatically on what can be done to prepare for extreme weather, for flooding, for heavy storms, that type of thing, without talking about climate change.
And I might bring in, does it matter? You know, the motivations, and if they lead to the same action, do we care whether they call it climate change or not? You can look at, for example, in the green building sector. You know, you can do surveys. Do you want a green building? No, I don't want any of that liberal stuff. Do you want a smart building? Absolutely. Do you want a super efficient building? Absolutely. Just don't give me a green building. Green has become politicized. Sustainability has become politicized. People hear green. They hear green jobs, green tech. They hear Solyndra. They hear government intrusion in the market. These are all the trigger issues, you know, that start to get evoked. Interestingly, in the last presidential election, there was a survey that came out, and a Romney supporter was more likely to do green improvements on their home than an Obama supporter, not to protect the environment, but because it saves them money. And does the motivation matter? I mean, at a certain time it does, but at least in these early stages, no, I don't think it does.
So kind of as a matter of let the devil take the details, let's just get these steps done.
You know, if we want to get people to drive 65, do we care whether they're afraid of getting a ticket or afraid of getting hurt or afraid of their damaging their car as long as they drive 65?
Except this doesn't address the cause, does it? It addresses the effects. Mm-hmm. How do you drill down to try to do things to address the causes?
Well, but you can still make that case on mitigation. I can give talks in business audiences and say you can be agnostic about the science of climate change and still see it as a business issue. Regulation may change it. Consumers, banks, insurance companies, all these things will drive changes in your market, and you don't have to believe climate change for 1 second to see those as real business issues.
You might see it as tippy-toeing around climate change, or you might see it as a smart way of getting done what needs doing and making everyone feel like, hey, I'm right.
Right.
Is that what you're finding, Jen?
It is. I think so. There's certainly a lot of that. And interestingly enough, at this conference that I attended at the University of Michigan, there were, among the people who were in attendance, were representatives and actually making presentations, I should add, representatives of ExxonMobil and Lafarge, the cement company, and representative of an agricultural association here in Michigan. So businesses are certainly aware that this is going on, and many of them even involved in some of the industries that are right in the thick of the battle over governmental policy and how you go about dealing with greenhouse gas emissions. But they recognize that something has to be done. And often, yes, it gets right back to how you sidestep some of the hot-button issues that get people stirred up and be more practical.
Mm-hmm. Do you think this strategy of couching the language behind local projects, could this make its way onto the larger stage, national or worldwide, basically letting the world prepare for the effects of a warming planet, even if we don't say that's what we're doing, Andy?
Yes, you can very strongly make a case that extreme weather events are increasing just by looking at insurance data coming out of some of the large, you know, Swiss Re, Munich Re. The trends are a steady upward trend. Whether it's resilience or preparedness, whether it's disaster preparedness, I don't think it needs to be called climate change to say that we can expect these payouts to be greater in the future. And I personally think the insurance sector is the one to watch. They can really drive this. If their payouts continue to go up, their premiums will go up with it, and that will get people to change whether they believe in climate change or not.
Could this, John, do you think this approach change or influence the way that we do view and understand climate change? Could it change the conversation?
Well, quite possibly. I think that any time you're talking about climate change, you have to deal with reality. You have to look at the science and That is where a lot of the debate is right now. I rather suspect that when you swing back to this question of mitigation, that is how you actually try to deal with climate change, hopefully slow it down and perhaps even stop it at some point in the future, you do have to be pretty open about what you're talking about. But if you can broaden the conversation to discuss not just what kind of sacrifices might have to be made, but the things that you can do to promote economic growth as a part of this, the industries like wind power and others that can actually be an outgrowth of this that could create jobs and could contribute to economic growth, that might be a good way to approach it.
And I would say that the debate is already changing because of it. If you look at public opinion surveys, national numbers on belief in climate change, it was on a steady decline from about 2008, 2009, till it bottomed out around 2012. Then has been on a slow upward trend. Some work that Barry Rabe here at the University of Michigan has done. Ask people, do you believe in climate change? And shows the numbers coming back up, and then gets to why. And it's the extreme weather. That is changing people's beliefs on this issue. So the news coverage, the visibility of the forest fires, the droughts, the flooding, and things like that. If you really want to get people to attend to this issue, you have to make it personally salient. And one of the most effective ways to do that is put a dollar sign on it. And so if the city of Chicago is worried about storm surge and they're starting to change their sewer systems and starting to incent green roofs in order to reduce storm surge, then that's what people see as salient and personal. And then they'll start to take it seriously. And I would add, by the way, I'm blanking on the insurance company. I think it was State Farm that just sued a number of communities around Chicago saying, you should have been prepared for these radical storms because of climate change, because your big neighbor on the lake is doing it too.
Well, so as you say, we watch and see what the insurance companies do. Mm-hmm. And certainly hitting home, if you lived in Southeast Michigan and you saw images of the intersection of 696 and I-75 that you may drive every day, and it's under 12 feet of water with divers because of that rain that hit everyone, and then you see piles of rotting garbage out on on boulevards for weeks thereafter, that really does slam it home in a way that no other conversation can.
But I have to throw in a quick caveat here before my climate scientists hammer me for doing this. We're talking about what changes public opinion. Scientists are quick to say that it's very hard to pin one storm event on climate change, but they do talk about severity and increasing frequency. Whether that storm in Detroit, we can say that's absolutely climate change. Scientists are not ready to go there.
They're not ready to go there.
Yep.
But the conversation can continue, and it's a slow process of awareness. Mm-hmm. And then meantime, flood control projects are being done, dams are being shored up, urban forests are being planted. So the folks on the local level who have found a politically astute way of doing this may be setting the stage for national and world strategy.
Precisely.
John Flesher is an environmental reporter for the Associated Press. He's based in Traverse City and recently did a report looking at the ways that local communities are preparing for the potentially severe local consequences without triggering the political minefields of partisan warfare over climate change. And Andy Hoffman is director of the Urban Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan. Thanks so much to both of you for speaking with us.
It was a pleasure being
here.
Thank
you.
For a lot of us, a newspaper encounter is not complete until you have done the crossword puzzle. And the New York Times crossword puzzle is one of the premier puzzles in the country. So when we heard that a Michigan puzzle constructor has been getting her puzzles onto the pages of the Times, we wanted to find out more. Tracy Bennett is with us. She's from the Ann Arbor area. Welcome.
Thank you.
So your themeless puzzle was just chosen to be in the New York Times last Friday. It's your second puzzle to make the Times.
That's right.
What are the special challenges of writing a themeless puzzle?
Well, a themeless puzzle typically has fewer words in it, so it's 72 words or less. That means you're going to have a lot of white space to fill, but you still have to meet a symmetry requirement so that when you turn the puzzle around, you have the same design, black squares and white squares.
And write creative, fun clues.
Right.
This sounds mind-boggling. How do you even, I mean, there's no crossword puzzle making 101 offered in college, right? Where does one learn to do this?
Well, I actually started going to the tournaments that Will Schwartz runs in Brooklyn. My friend and mentor I found there, and he has taught me the skill. So first I started solving, of course, and so I could understand what they are.
So you start from the ground up. So
right.
You're a fan of doing them.
Yes, I've been solving since I was 16. I guess when I was a very small child, 17 months, I was into jigsaw puzzles, and it just went on from there.
So you've become a constructor who's seen two of your puzzles make the New York Times. So that's kind of making it the big time, isn't it?
Yes, yes. Well, I've had one in the LA Times too. And I have a byline now at Bust Magazine. So that comes out every other month.
How long does it take to, for example, the piece that was in the Times last Friday? It sounds like it would be a ferocious amount of time to put all of that together.
It is. And I don't have a lot of time, discretionary time, because I'm a mother and I work full time and a wife also. So I set aside about 4 hours a week, usually on the weekends, to do puzzle making. And so it would take me about 3 weeks or more sometimes to make one puzzle. The more phrases you can have, the more lively the puzzle is for the solver.
Now, I read that only 1-2% of themeless puzzles come from women.
That's true.
And
actually, over the last 30 years, the number of women making crossword puzzles has gone down. Nobody knows why. There is some non-feminist and feminist points of view on this. So the more feminist point of view is that there are only male gatekeepers right now at these publications, and not that they're consciously not choosing work by women, but that they might prefer themes, just gravitate toward themes that men generate.
What's another theory?
Another theory is that the advent of software, this is one I really don't subscribe to, the advent of software and word list software and automatic filling software has made men gravitate toward the field and intimidated women.
But now that you've made the New York Times, you've got a byline in Bust, you've made the LA Times, so you could just keep plugging away.
Yes.
This is a hobby, do you see it, or is it a second job? How do you view this?
I think it's switching from hobby to second job and possibly retirement, you know, pursuit. I really am always making puzzles. I'm always solving them. I'm trying to solve everything that's published and teach myself the craft.
And how do you keep your voice distinct from others when you're thinking of a word and you want to build a clue and you want it to be yours? You certainly don't want
right.
to can't you know be caught.
Well, Will Shortz rewrites half at least of the clues that he publishes, and he makes some really excellent choices. You know, and other times I feel like, wow, I don't see myself in that puzzle because there's so much that's been written by somebody else. People who write their own clues tend to be self-indulgent without realizing it. Editors are also looking for where there are difficult crossings. They might have to make a clue easier than what the constructor chose.
So it gets tweaked. Do you have a favorite clue from last Friday's puzzle?
I like punny clues, the ones that end in question marks. I had exchange words, but if you flip that a little bit, the pronunciation, you get exchange words, and the answer is I'll trade you.
Ah.
So it's kind of a trick of language.
Tracy Bennett, her themeless crossword puzzle was just in last Friday's New York Times, her second time making the paper. Good to meet you, Tracy. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you very much.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Michelle Hahn, Haley Hirschman, and Annie Norris. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.